As promised, we're joined right now by the national NBA writer for the Washington Post, host of Greatest of All Talk, an NBA show, host of Open Floor Podcast, friend of this program. He is Ben Golliver. Ben, how have you been doing during the middle of this pandemic, Ben?
Well, you want the short version or the long version, right? I mean, I feel like that's the answer every time somebody asks that. I'm doing well, hanging in there, good health. My family's all good, and I hope the same for you too, Jim.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, Ben. Me too, and I understand exactly what you're saying. There is a short answer, and there is a long answer. All right, so there is no NBA right now, though. But we did have The Last Dance. Overall, what did you make of the 10 episodes of The Last Dance?
Well, as a guy growing up, just completely indoctrinated sort of in the MJ fan cult, I thought it was awesome. It was a fun look back, a nostalgic look back. I saw a lot of players. I saw a lot of media members, maybe under the age of 30, who were learning some of the stories that we grew up on, and I thought that was great. To me, I think it's important to remember how his fingerprints were all over this project, right? You know, we have to acknowledge that we're getting the story that Michael Jordan wants us to watch. And it's interesting what he included in that story and what he didn't. For example, he's willing to talk about some of the gambling stuff, some of the political drama, but he doesn't necessarily want to show us his family. He's not even necessarily taping his interviews at his own home. And so to me, I saw a guy who in retirement still very much cherishes his privacy, definitely still has parts of his personality that he doesn't want to show to us as a viewer, and a guy who obviously wants the conversation to stay on the court. Because when he was on the court, he was an absolute killer. And we saw him just, you know, mow down Isaiah Thomas, Magic Johnson, Clyde Drexler, Charles Barkley, Gary Payton, John Stockton, Karl Malone in order, you know, episode by episode. And, it's an incredible career. And to me, I think he steps away from this, making his case. He's the greatest of all time. And in basketball circles, and he's not matched right now.
All right, so Ben, speaking of retirement, like at the end of the series, when Jordan's talking about the fact that he regrets that he didn't get the opportunity to win a seventh title, does it seem to you like he's settled and comfortable in retirement?
Oh, not at all. I mean, that's probably he settles every score on the court, but this is one that he can't settle because it was out of his control. I mean, his whole plan of, hey, let's all take one-year deals, that sounds great when you're Michael Jordan and you're one-year deals for $30 million late in your career. Try to sell that idea to Scottie Pippen or some of those other role players who had never really had a big payday to that point. I mean, I think there were some very real problems facing that front office. And there's no question, you know, Jerry Reinsdorf and Jerry Krause deserve some serious blame for how they handled things going into that 97-98 season. I mean, they just, you know, didn't have everybody on the same page. You know, if Phil Jackson goes 82-0, he's going to be cast aside no matter what. I mean, to me, some of that public relations stuff is inexcusable, but there's no question. Guys were getting old. Dennis Rodman's going to, Detroit for a wrestling, a battle during the middle of the NBA Finals. He's on his last legs. Pippen's obviously wanting to get paid. I mean, to me, it was just a natural ending for that run to kind of come together at the same time. And Jordan just didn't plan it well enough. You know, he didn't see into the future. He didn't realize that some of those other guys were going to want to get taken care of financially, and it kind of all blew up in his face. But the bottom line is he went out with a bang in 98. I mean, that final shot, the entire sequence where he goes layup, steal from Karl Malone, and then final shot, to me, it's arguably the best minute of basketball in his career, and maybe the best minute that anybody's ever played.
We were talking to Ben Golliver. You know, one of the really interesting moments I thought, Ben, in the series was the discussion of Scottie Pippen sitting out at the end of Game 3 of the 94 Conference Semis. Pippen said, quote, "It's one of those incidents where I wish it never happened, but if I had a chance to do it over again, I probably wouldn't change it," end quote. It's a really curious comment to me. What do you make of it?
Yeah, there was so much to take from the Scottie Pippen experience for this whole documentary. If I was him, I'd be watching this thing like, come on, man, I won 6 titles, and we're going to talk about my migraine, the time that I sit out with because of Kukoc, and then the fact that I had back spasms in 98. It's like all of his low moments got all this attention, right? To me, I think the big takeaway from that sit-down situation where Phil Jackson says, Tony, you're going to take the shot, Scottie's not, it would never happen in today's NBA, Jim. The superstars just have that level of clout. They would be able to overrule the play if they wanted. The coach would probably not try to defy them in the first place. They would just give them the ball. And look, if they ultimately did sit out, there would be a crazy media storm. Everyone would be freaking out. It would be much worse even than what Scottie Pippen faced in the 90s. And then after the fact, you know, if Pippen really felt snubbed by his organization in today's day and age, he could get his coach fired or he could demand a trade. And it's just those weren't things that were available to him back in the 90s. So I think that specific scene, but as well as the entire Pippen story where they're kind of dwelling on his low moments, it really made me feel sympathetic and a little bit sad for Scottie Pippen. I mean, the ultimate number two guy. How often do we see NBA players these days willingly cede to an alpha dog for their entire prime like Scottie Pippen did? Certainly he benefited. You know, he has six titles to show for it, and he's still a very prominent NBA figure, considered one of the top 50 greatest players of all time, of course. But, you know, taking that number two role is not easy, especially when you realize you're one of the best players in the entire league.
You know, Ben, what I thought was really interesting was Scottie said, I had an opportunity to play with the best player ever. I had an opportunity to play for the best coach ever. We had the best general manager ever. I mean, obviously, Jerry Krause did not really fare well in this documentary at all. Now, he deserves a lot of credit for assembling the roster, and he's not able to defend himself in the series, but they did let that through. Mike let that through. He did say it. Scottie said he was the best GM ever, so I thought that was interesting in and of itself. Put that aside, how much blame do you think Krause deserves for situations with Phil Jackson and Scottie Pippen, among others?
Well, first thing on the greatest GM ever comment, I mean, to me, we need a lie detector version of this documentary, don't we? I mean, it's funny that Scottie's the one who says it. Michael never says anything along those lines, right? So we know where Michael really stands. And similarly, there's times where, you know, Jordan was saying things about Pippen like, oh, he had a migraine. You know, I had to understand in that moment he couldn't play. And I kind of wish we had the lie detector on Michael Jordan to hear what he really felt about some of those moments, given just how pivotal they were for the Bulls story. In terms of Krause's role, though, look, he did an amazing job building that roster. I mean, he really, you know, even getting Pippen in the first place, having the guts to go out and put a first-time coach like Phil Jackson into that role, you know, a seldom-known assistant coach, you know, to replace Doug Collins with him, even though they're already a successful team in the playoffs, that's a huge move. And not a lot of GMs today would have that kind of sway or have that have that level of influence within their organization. But to me, it's like he does deserve a lot of the blame for the way that it fell apart, because everybody was unhappy. These were all champions. It should have just been a money machine. It should have been a title ring machine. He should have been going back to ownership and saying, look, we need to keep these guys together. We need to spend big to keep this group. We see it all the time in the modern NBA where owners are going deep in the luxury tax to keep together title teams. I mean, that's the sign of good ownership and good management, and he just wasn't able to do that. I mean, I think ultimately they cut corners. They gave Jordan just enough help so that they could get across the finish line, and then the whole thing blew up in their face.
Ben Golver is joining us. Ben is a critical thinker and a veteran journal. I'm curious about this. And you understand this, because I pose the question does not mean that I have the answer, know the answer, or even necessarily have an opinion. But in terms of the pizza, the poison pizza, you know, when you hear that story, and we've all heard the story now, five guys delivered the pizza, only one person ate the pizza, Mike ate the pizza. Does that sound legitimate to you, or does that smell fishy to you?
No, it definitely seems like a fish story, right, where just the whole story gets a little bit bigger and bigger every time it gets told, and all of a sudden there's five guys delivering one pizza, and they're trying to look in to see if it's Michael Jordan, and it sounds like it's a scene out of Sopranos or something. Look, I don't know. I wasn't there. Certainly what we do know is Jordan was not right. And I've actually had food poisoning before, and I looked a lot like Jordan looked during that game. So whether it was food poisoning or a hangover, like some people want to suggest, or whatever else, he was not, in very good shape. That's just a remarkable game, though, because those Jazz teams, to me, Jim, were really underrated by history. And I actually think they got a little bit snubbed in this documentary, too. I think they should have talked more about the power of that John Stockton, Karl Malone combination. Instead, they got caught up in all the Brian Russell trash talking and, oh, the fans are crazy in Utah and the food poisoning stuff. That was a really, really good, strong, tested, smart team that made back-to-back finals and kind of pushed Jordan right to the edge in that flu game. And then again, he looks absolutely exhausted by the end of the 1998 finals, too. So for me, I think it's just another chapter of the Jordan lore. I'm not sure we're ever supposed to know what really happened, and maybe that makes it a little bit more magical.
I think you're right, Ben. And that was my point. I don't know exactly what happened. You know, we can raise any kind of objection or question, but the fact of the matter is the guy was wrecked. The guy was not right, and he went out there and had an amazing game. I also echo what you say about the Utah Jazz. Those were damn good teams, really good teams. Karl Malone was unbelievable. John Stockton was incredible. Together, they were unbelievable. Great, great coach in Jerry Sloan, I thought. That was tough. Those were really good teams. All right, so finally, what's your overall impression of Jordan coming out of this series? Do you see him or feel any differently about him coming out than you did going in?
No, I just think it's a deeper, a richer portrait. I mean, the same themes have been there since the 90s, right? All this guy cares about is winning. He's willing to win at all costs. He doesn't care if he runs over some teammates or his coaches or his general manager in the first place. You know, whatever it takes to get the job done. And I think ultimately, like, he looks like a product of his time, right? I think a lot of modern players are looking at Jordan and saying, if this guy called me the names that he's calling Scott Burrell, I wouldn't take it. I would be out. And I think the NBA culture and climate has changed pretty significantly. It's not like, you know, all touchy-feely and you know, kumbaya now. But I do think that some of the stuff that Jordan was doing on a regular basis in the 90s probably wouldn't fly in the modern NBA, if only because there'd be so much more scrutiny attached to them. They'd be dissected on Twitter and put on every NBA talk show and everything else. So I think from that standpoint, we do have a distancing effect from the Jordan era, from Jordan the person. But I think ultimately he stated his case very, very well. I don't know if you remember this, Jim. A few years ago, LeBron had an interview where he basically called himself the greatest of all time. He said, look, you know, when I won that 2016 title, I felt like that made me the greatest. I think in that moment, you know, LeBron told us that. And I think with this documentary, Jordan showed us that he feels like he's the greatest of all time. He never comes out and says it directly, but he's got Obama, you know, he's got Justin Timberlake. He's got all these different people kind of weighing in on his influence and his fame. And that scene where they go to Paris and the front of the newspaper says, Michael Jordan is bigger than the Pope. It's like, okay, now we really know what we're dealing with. This is a level of celebrity and fame that just no real modern athlete can kind of live up to right now. And to me, I think ultimately it was a very convincing case by him.
No, Ben, and to your point, it's a very good point. And to your point, if I'm not mistaken, did Mike not green light this finally right around the time that LeBron made that statement?
Right. And, you know, it's funny. How long do you wait, right? What's the appropriate amount of time? Because when I'm watching him, like, bump into Leonardo DiCaprio in the hallway after the 1998 finals, it's like, how could this ever sit in a vault for 22 years? Somebody didn't want to put this scene out. It's just such incredible footage, right? But I think that wound up being a masterstroke. And I think, unfortunately, because of the coronavirus, like, their timing was perfect. I mean, the ratings were excellent. I think 5 or 6 million people for every single episode. And, you know, I think from that standpoint, this whole project came together as probably as well as they could have hoped, especially considering the circumstances. But the guy is a competitor, right? I mean, look at how much he hated the idea that the media would put Clyde Drexler into the same sentence as him. Do you think he feels any differently when guys like us are saying Jordan or LeBron, you know, LeBron or Jordan? I'm sure that stuff grinds his gears. And I think ultimately this project winds up, you know, being this this case for himself, right? This moment that traces his entire career, his many high moments, gives a little bit of his personality and lets him kind of answer all questions on all topics.
I just wonder. I wonder, like we watched Kobe in retirement and he seemed fulfilled and he had other things. I can only imagine what LeBron's going to be in retirement. Do you really think that LeBron's going to be grinding gears and running on that same fuel that Kobe was in retirement? No, I don't think so, right?
No, I hear you, man. Look, Jordan was great at basketball, but evolution, not really his thing, right? I mean, he definitely still...
That's a great line right there, Ben.
Those same... Like, Isaiah Thomas kills him today, just like Isaiah Thomas killed him in 1990. And, you know, there's that's an admirable quality, too, right? Like, he's not going to change for anybody. He is who he is. It's a little bit old school. It's a little bit traditional. But to me, I do respect it. I mean, he's still got the cigars. He's still got the scotch, you know, just like he wanted to, you know, back in the 90s. I mean, I don't think that he has changed, you know, fundamentally, at least his public presentation. Now, people will say, you know, he's like this very doting grandfather now, right? And again, he enjoys his privacy. So he's got an entire private life that he's not letting us into. But I think from the public side, he knows what his image is and he knows how to maintain it, you know, perfectly or immaculately. I mean, he's really worked on that for years and years and years. This guy is a media genius. I mean, you could see when he's going in front of those cameras, night after night after night, he's not slipping up. He's saying exactly what's on his mind, and he's getting his points across.
And actually saying things, I agree. Ben Golver, national NBA writer for the Washington Post, host of Greatest of All Talk and NBA Show, host of Open Floor podcast, and a good friend of the show. Ben, great job. Thanks for closing the show for me.